Hi, I'm Connie Loizis.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Hello, everyone. How are you? It's Friday, October 30th, and many of us are experiencing strong feelings, excitement, dread, anticipation, fear. And that's just about Halloween. Is it canceled this year? Should you still buy candy? Can you eat the candy that you already bought if you're pretty sure your neighbors will not be coming by? Simple answers are hard to come by these days, but we'll do our best to answer at least some of your questions about the week's biggest and strangest stories, as well as in this week's interview with the one and only Steve Case, the co-founder and longtime CEO of America Online, one of the country's first internet service providers and the company responsible for sounds you will recognize if you are a dinosaur, such as...
You've got mail.
Case was also there when the Communications Decency Act was passed into law in 1996, and with it, Section 230, which has given internet companies broad protections ever since regarding the content that appears on their sites. We talk with Case about that provision 25 years later. We also talk about what a Biden presidency could mean, whether he thinks Silicon Valley might truly lose its edge in this pandemic, and how one organizes a virtual bus tour. But first, the news.
On Wednesday, the Senate Commerce Committee summoned Google CEO Sundar Pichai, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg to discuss Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, a provision that relieves social media companies of responsibility for most user-generated content. At least that's what the hearing was supposed to be about. If you guessed that a hearing involving Google, Twitter, and Facebook, held only days before the presidential election, might involve more than a discussion of the 26 words in Section 230, you were right. A New York Post article about emails that were supposedly found on Hunter Biden's laptop was chief among Senator Ted Cruz's concerns. Citing the article's unproven claims, Twitter had banned the story before reversing itself just 24 hours later, giving rise to a patented Cruz Jeremiad. "Mr. Dorsey," he thundered, "who the hell elected you and put you in charge of what the media are allowed to report and what the American people are allowed to hear?" But perhaps the strangest moment occurred when Senator Marsha Blackburn asked Google CEO Sundar Pichai about an engineer named Blake Lemoine. "He has had very unkind things to say about me, and I was just wondering if you all had still kept him working there," she explained.
Hopefully tonight or else very soon, I'll be publishing a story on a topic that's top of mind for a lot of aspiring venture capitalists out there right now, which is how to raise a fund if you're not rich. It's a question that wasn't even asked 5 to 10 years ago. It was just assumed that if you hadn't risen up the ranks of a venture firm or made a ton of money by selling your company or seen a windfall as an early employee of a tech giant like Google, there was essentially no way you could consider a career in venture. Why not? Because VCs are typically expected to write a check for up to 3% of whatever amount of money they're raising in order to show outside investors that they have so-called skin in the game. You want to show alignment with your outside investors. But as more attention has been paid to groups who've been shut out of venture, including because they are more capital constrained, would-be VCs are beginning to realize or should know that there are ways around this capital commitment. One of these is chipping a lot less into a fund than 3% of its overall assets based on your personal wealth or lack thereof. Asked about this yesterday, institutional investors with whom I spoke said it's fine. It's all relative, they said. If you can prove that you can access smart founders and you've got good judgment, that's more important to them. Another option involves deferring management fees, which some first-time investors do. A third option is called front-loading, where you pay yourself out of management fees that you'd otherwise be collecting over time. It's something that famed investor Chris Sacca did when he was getting started. There are even bank loans you can get depending on your investor base. All involve varying degrees of difficulty, but then again, so does starting any business. In any case, if you or someone you love wants to jump into VC but thinks they can't because you don't have a big bank account, look out for the piece. It's called You Can Start a Venture Fund If You're Not Rich. Here's how.
And now, in the latest installment of CEOs Behaving Badly, two stories for your consideration. Verkada is a startup that makes security cameras. Up until recently, it was doing pretty well. In early 2020, the company was valued at $1.6 billion, and its workforce had grown to just over 400 employees. But because of an incident that has just surfaced, Verkada will now forever be known as the company that attempted to use its cap table to cover up a case of sexual harassment. Last year, it seems, a sales director used Verkada's cameras to take photos of colleagues, which were then posted in a Slack channel called Raw Verkada Dogs. Face match, find me a squirt, the sales director wrote to accompanying LOLs and smiley faces. Instead of immediately firing everyone involved, the company decided to give them two options: leave the company or accept a reduction in their stock options. Predictably, all of the employees involved chose the latter option. The company has since changed course and fired the employees, but the damage has been done. Surveillance startups used own cameras to harass coworkers will be one of the top search results for Verkada for a long time to come. And now, the second installment in our series. This past Tuesday, would-be comedian Joe Rogan ignited a storm of criticism through once again hosting conspiracy theorist Alex Jones on his popular Spotify podcast. Jones is perhaps best known for claiming that a shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, that killed six adult staff members and 20 children between 6 and 7 years old, was nothing more than an elaborate hoax. Although he is also known for asserting that the government has, quote, weather weapons, chemicals in the water are turning frogs gay, Robert Mueller is a demon and a pedophile, and Hillary Clinton is running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor. Full disclosure, Alex Jones didn't invent this last one, but he has promoted it. In the past, Spotify's employees have protested Jones's appearance on Rogan's podcast, but to no avail. Rogan apparently has carte blanche to do what he wants. On Thursday, Spotify announced that The Joe Rogan Experience is now the number one show in its English-speaking markets, and the company is still apparently paying him according to the terms of a deal that The Wall Street Journal estimated to be worth more than $100 million. In an internal memo leaked this week to BuzzFeed News, Horacio Gutierrez, Spotify's chief legal officer and head of global affairs, stated, "We are not going to ban specific individuals from being guests on other people's shows, as the episode show complies with our content policies."
Heading into the election, some founders can't help but express publicly which candidate they hope will win the race. Last week, the CEO of Expensify, a privately held company that makes expense management software for personal and business use, wrote the company's 10 million customers a note, telling them that we are, quote, "facing an unprecedented attack on the foundations of democracy itself. And if you're a U.S. citizen, anything less than a vote for Biden is a vote against democracy," end quote. The CEO, David Barrett, went on to argue that although companies are expected to remain neutral, Expensify, quote, "depends on a functioning society and economy, and not many expense reports get filed during a civil war," end quote. It was probably not a great business decision. According to Business Insider, Expensify employees have been inundated with messages from customers, as well as from, surprise, surprise, people creating accounts and pretending to be angry customers. Two of Expensify's competitors said their sales leads have exploded since the email went out. Similarly, we've seen other CEOs take stances that may have felt satisfying, but may also prove counterproductive from a business perspective. Still, as the New York Times noted in a piece earlier this week called "To Do Politics or Not to Do Politics," even those wishing to stay out of things are finding it hard to avoid. Last weekend, on the heels of recently losing 60 of his employees for insisting that they keep politics out of the workplace, the CEO of Coinbase, Brian Armstrong, shared on Twitter a fellow CEO's blog post that endorsed Kanye West for president. "Epic," Armstrong tweeted. Called out shortly afterward for his apparent hypocrisy in sharing something political after telling his employees to abstain, Armstrong later deleted the tweet. Up next, our interview with Steve Case, who today leads the sprawling investment firm Revolution from Washington, D.C. But first, a word from our sponsor.
The world's largest technology conference returns for its 10th edition this December, when Web Summit will take place on an all-new purpose-built platform. 2020 has led to inflection points for many industries, including the public and private markets. Are SPACs, rolling funds, and direct listings here to stay? Which asset classes will continue to appreciate into 2021? Join Mark Cuban, Fred Wilson, and Aileen Lee, as well as more than 1,000 investors on Web Summit's Investors Track, as they explore these inflection points and the state of venture in 2020 and beyond. Investors listening can reserve their place on Web Summit's Investor Track at websummit.com/strictlyVC. That's websummit.com/strictlyVC. Web Summit 2020, running December 2nd to December 4th.
Steve, it's a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Great to be with you.
You've been talking about this idea that Silicon Valley is losing its gravitational pull for many years, and COVID-19 would seem to be accelerating the shift. What does it mean to you that all these people have moved out of the Bay Area over the last 6 months? How do you see this playing out over the next year or several years?
Well, obviously, the jury is out. I think a lot of people who decided to leave Silicon Valley and shelter someplace else, most of those will end up returning. I don't think you'll see a mass exodus from these cities, whether it be Silicon Valley or New York or Boston, which some have been predicting that was probably a little much. But I do think some of the people who decided to leave, at least temporarily, will decide to stay. And most of them will end up still working for the current company, in part because some of the tech companies like Facebook and Square and many others have made it easier to work remotely. But some, once they get settled in another place and their family is settled in another place, likely will decide to do something different. So I think it could be a helpful catalyst in terms of these rise of the rest cities, where cities that were showing some signs of momentum, this could be an accelerant. Much as we've talked about, the pandemic accelerated some tech trends around things like e-commerce, telehealth, and other areas. I think it could very well accelerate the trends around talent dispersing around the country, which, if then coupled with capital, can result in more and more breakout unicorn-type companies rising in more and more cities around the country.
Have you seen any of that happening yet? The Stripe engineer who ends up in the Midwest, who is also creating a company on the side and looking for capital?
Yeah, it's still mostly anecdotal. For them, this has been the shake the snow globe moment. The 8 months of reflection is leading some to maybe make a different decision. I want to be clear. I love Silicon Valley. It will remain the leader of the pack for sure. Will continue to be where a lot of great companies are birthed and scaled. It's still the pride of America, the envy of the world. That's not changing. But at the same time, we do think there are other places that can rise. You don't have to be in Silicon Valley to be a successful entrepreneur. We know that. And part of our Rise the Rest effort has been trying to level that playing field so people can choose where they want to live, as opposed to feeling like they have to be in a place like Silicon Valley, because that's where all the other people focus on the innovation economy is. That's where most of the money is, et cetera, et cetera.
Steve, many people in our audience are familiar with Rise of the Rest and Revolution Group, but I was wondering if you could just give us a short overview of Rise of the Rest and how it fits into Revolution Group, and also how you are operating Rise of the Rest virtually.
Revolution started after almost 15 years ago, after I stepped aside as CEO of AOL when we merged with Time Warner, and decided rather than start another company, I would start an investment firm to back entrepreneurs who are pursuing different disruptive ideas. And that really has developed, particularly over the past decade, where we have three parts of Revolution. Revolution Growth, which are the later stage growth investments, things like DraftKings and BigCommerce that went public in the last few months, Clear, Sweetgreen, Sportradar. They were typically, like most growth funds, writing $20, $30, $40 million checks. We also have Revolution Ventures, which is a classic Series A, sometimes Series B fund, generally writing initial checks in the $5 million range, again, across a variety of different sectors. And then the Rise of the Rest Seed Fund is the most recent. We just launched that about 3 years ago. So far, we've backed more than 150 companies in more than 70 cities. And the thesis there is exactly what we're talking about, that even though a lot of great entrepreneurs are in places like New York City and in San Francisco and Boston, given that most of the venture capital focus is there, let's focus elsewhere. There, we're typically writing, we'll call it a $500,000 first check, alongside usually regional investors. So far, we've co-invested with more than 200 funds. So that's what the Rise the Rest strategy is about. So the way I think about Revolution now is we're able to help entrepreneurs at every stage of their development, whether that's really early seed stage or that next step, the venture stage or the real growth stage. We have separate teams, separate funds that are optimized to help at each of those stages.
Steve, it's great that you've formed these relationships with local VCs. I'm wondering, during this time specifically, are you seeing more or less activity or interest from the coastal VCs? The numbers seem to suggest that women and underrepresented groups are getting less funding right now because a lot of VCs who are doing their deals via Zoom are relying on their traditional networks, and those networks don't always include these other groups.
Yeah, that's a concern. And it's a concern about place. It's also a concern about people. If you just look at the NVCA data, last year, 75% of venture capital went to just three states. And last year, more than 90% of venture capital went to men, less than 10% to women, even though women represent half our population. And last year, even though Black Americans are about 14% of the population, Black founders got less than 1% of venture capital. So if you just look at the data, it does matter where you live. It does matter what you look like. It does matter what school you went to. What we're trying to do is just level that playing field. And I would have thought that because of the pandemic and because suddenly Zoom meetings for pitches were becoming increasingly commonplace, that would open up the aperture for most venture capitalists. They would be more willing to reach out to some of the diverse communities that maybe they don't really have traditionally invested in. Some of that has happened. We have seen more interest among coastal investors in opportunities in these Rise of the Rest cities. I think the challenge more broadly when you go beyond place towards people is what you hear from more of these venture capitalists, I'm sure you've seen this as well, is they say, yes, we understand that it's a problem we need to help solve. It's also an opportunity we can potentially seize because some of these entrepreneurs are going to build some really valuable companies, but we don't really have the network. The networks we have tend to be mostly situated where we live and have worked or potentially went to school and also where we previously made investments. So we just don't have the networks in the middle of the country. We don't have networks with Black founders and so forth. So that's the area that we're really focusing on now. How do we extend the networks? And that's why we decided to launch a Rise the Rest Equity Edition virtual tour. And then the first week of December, we planned a number of events, including a pitch competition for Black founders. The winner will get a $1 million investment from the Rise the Rest Fund and Morgan Stanley. But more importantly, we've invited venture capitalists to join us for this, both the pitch competition, and we've asked them to each do meetings with some of the entrepreneurs who applied, and hundreds have already applied. And so far, more than 100 venture capitalists have signed up for that. So we'll bring them along on this virtual tour. And our hope is not just we'll identify some promising companies to invest in as part of the pitch competition, but dozens, maybe even hundreds of companies will have access to capital through the network we're creating of VCs around this Equity Edition tour that they otherwise wouldn't have had, which will help those entrepreneurs. And equally important, the venture capitalists who are saying, I want to lean into this. I want to do more. Help me with essentially deal flow will be connected with entrepreneurs who are building interesting businesses.
I think that's great. One thing that I hear from people of color and women is that the funding tends to dry up as their companies mature. I have a concern, as you made too, about whether or not VCs are following through on these investments as these companies mature. One thing I thought was interesting, of course, was last week when David Swensen apparently told US-based money managers that received checks from Yale that Yale's endowment will now be grading them on how they do in terms of diversity, in terms of hiring women and other underrepresented groups into their ranks to write checks. How impactful do you think that will be?
I think it'd be very impactful. I think the Yale obviously is arguably the most respected endowment. So I think that statement is going to be important. Larry Fink from BlackRock, more of on the institutional side, has also made a lot of statements recently about trying to be more inclusive. I think that leadership matters. The Business Roundtable, similarly, more on the impact side, has said that capitalism needs to not just focus on profit, focus on purpose. These things initially do start as talk, and some people say, well, it's just talk, but you don't get action until you first start with talk. You have to get the idea in play. You have to put it in motion. And so leaders talking about this, I think, is important. It opens the eyes of some people that maybe weren't otherwise paying attention. It galvanizes some action that maybe it wouldn't have otherwise happened. So I think that's a positive in terms of a more inclusive approach to venture capital and entrepreneurship.
You're based in Washington, D.C., and you're probably aware of the backlash that has been building against tech. In particular, there have been some pretty heated hearings yesterday and this week with various tech CEOs. And there seems to be a real anger in Congress that's being directed towards companies like Facebook and Google. What are your reactions to what's going on? And have you had any experiences in talking with people in the political world? And what are some of the misperceptions or insights that they've had that you've found to be relevant?
It does not surprise me. I've actually been talking about the backlash against big tech broadly, Silicon Valley in particular, for several years. Even the book I wrote, The Third Wave, came out, I think, about 4 years ago. That was one of the themes. And some of that because of the power of these platforms, the tremendous success of Google, Facebook, et cetera, and the influence they have, not just in business, but in society, even in terms of elections. It was clear that there was going to be more visibility. I was obviously part of the first wave of the internet when we started AOL 35 years ago. Only 3% of people were connected. They were only online about an hour a week. And it was still illegal, actually, for consumers or businesses to be on the internet. We had to create a parallel universe of online services. And so I spent a lot of time on commercializing the internet, opening up to obviously consumers and businesses, figuring out what the right rules of the road were in terms of things like taxes on e-commerce. And generally, we were able to convince regulators that a light touch for the internet made sense because it was a new idea. It wasn't clear exactly how it was going to develop. But now it's not a new idea, and now it has a profound impact on people's lives and our communities and countries, et cetera. And so I'm not surprised that there's more focus on it. It's a little too bad that there's so much attention right this moment, because in an election season, things tend to get a little bit hot. But putting that aside, I think there are legitimate issues that the policymakers need to be looking at and are starting to look at, not just in Washington, D.C., but more broadly in Brussels. And I think having more of a dialogue between the innovators and the policymakers is actually going to be critical in this internet third wave, because the sectors up for grabs are the most important aspects of our lives, things like healthcare and education and food and agriculture and things like that. And that's really going to require not just innovation from a technology standpoint, but thoughtfulness from a policy standpoint. So hopefully the coin has dropped, and hopefully folks do realize that there is a legitimate role for government to play. I understand entrepreneurs who get frustrated by regulations slowing down the pace of information. I get that. Obviously, some of the businesses that we back have suffered from that. But at the same time, you can't not expect the government, which is elected by the people, to serve the people, including protecting the people in areas like healthcare. Of course, we may chafe at regulations. Of course, we want drugs to medical devices to be safe and effective. And that's why policy is going to become much more important in the next 10 or 20 years.
Speaking of yesterday's hearings, obviously Section 230 is of great interest to so many people, including VCs who want their companies to thrive. Right before we got on, I was looking at Section 230 as it relates to AOL, and I'd seen that years ago, this Seattle-based video producer had sued AOL after a troll repeatedly posted vile jokes about the Oklahoma City bombing on an AOL bulletin board. And the company was protected by Section 230, which had been passed not that long before this happened. So I'm just wondering what you think of it. Do you think it needs to be revamped?
The 230 provision was something I was involved in. I do think the first lawsuit related to it was related to AOL. But now, again, it's 25 years later, and it's fair to take a fresh look at it, appropriate to take a fresh look at it. I think it's fair to say that what made sense in those early days when very few people were online, maybe doesn't make as much sense now when the entire world is online and the impact these platforms have is so significant. At the same time, I think you have to be super careful. I think that's what the CEOs testifying were trying to emphasize, that we get that there's a desire to relook at. We also get that because of the election season, it's become a hot potato, highly politicized issue. Let's engage in this discussion. And perhaps there are some things that need to be modified to reflect the current reality. Let's have that discussion. Don't overreact, and let's don't do it just in the heat of a political moment.
Given you are in Washington and you have focused on healthcare and know the players in the industry, and given what's going on with COVID, do you see any investment opportunities for Evolution in trying to help the country prepare for future pandemics or to cope with what's going on right now?
Yes, actually, we have some investments. The flagship, if you will, of Revolution is the Revolution Growth Fund, obviously the later stage funds. We've done a number of things there. One company we backed, Tempus in Chicago, is focused mostly on big data and oncology, how to create an environment where when you're diagnosed with cancer, it's a more precise diagnosis, so the oncologists know what to do as opposed to trying to guess. But they also, in the last 7 or 8 months, because of the pandemic, have created a significant business around COVID testing. Similarly, we've invested in Talkspace that's focused on digital mental health in the telehealth space. They've seen a dramatic acceleration over the last 6 months, which obviously is good for their business, but also just as a reminder how difficult this pandemic is for so many people. There's a lot of people really struggling. Mental health has been an issue that's been building for decades, but it's really become more pronounced over the last 7 or 8 months. Also, a company we backed, again, out of the Revolution Growth Fund, Clear, which most people probably think of as a company focused on airport security, kind of a fast pass to get you to your plane faster. They, over the last 7 or 8 months, have focused on also adding a health pass aspect to, you know, leveraging their technology. They've worked with some of the sports leagues that were creating bubbles to protect their players. They're now talking to a lot of other organizations and offices and others how to use their technology to keep people safe. So I think the pandemic, you know, obviously has had some terrible, terrible, you know, consequences in terms of 250,000 people have died, tens of millions of people have lost their jobs. Don't want to underestimate the seriousness of the pandemic. But like many situations, sometimes crisis creates opportunity. And I think some of the entrepreneurs we've backed have recognized that they had to shift from the hunker down, managing through the crisis, to taking a step back, reimagining how the world has changed and how some of those changes are likely to be permanent, and adjusted some of their strategies to take advantage of essentially some of these new opportunities.
Really interesting about Clear. I had no idea. I've seen so many interesting pivots during this time, and I really admire the pluck of entrepreneurs.
Yeah, they just never give up. So, okay, well, you can't go this way. Well, I'm going to go that way instead.
Right, right. Steve, also mentioning trends right now, you said you invested in DraftKings. What do you think about this whole race to launch a SPAC? A, would Revolution think about launching one if it hasn't already? And B, do you think the traditional IPO process is ineffective and that we need alternatives like this?
I worked 6-7 years ago on the Jobs Act, Jumpstarting Our Business Startups Act, when I was working with the White House on a number of entrepreneurship initiatives, including chairing Startup America. And part of the Jobs Act, the centerpiece really, was trying to update the rules of the road in terms of companies going public. So younger, smaller companies had a somewhat more streamlined approach. And it took a few years for the SEC to settle on the rules, but I think that has been helpful. There were more IPOs this year, and including the BigCommerce, one other company we backed that had a very successful IPO. But in addition to that, I think having other ways to access capital is important. Direct listings, particularly with being able to include some primary shares, I think is going to be helpful and appropriate for some companies. And SPACs are going to be helpful and appropriate for some companies. And particularly when the sponsor can not just provide some capital, but hopefully help the companies scale to the next level, or it's a complicated deal. DraftKings, which we backed, did go public via a three-way merger, including with a SPAC. So that was an example where the SPAC was helpful. So I think SPACs will continue to be a permanent part of the landscape. I think some of the last few months, there's been I want to try to call it a mania, but it seemed like there've been a lot of SPAC and maybe some that are not as, you know, differentiated over time. I think it will settle out over time. I think the economics, including for sponsors, will settle out and likely be more performance-oriented, back-end oriented. So they only make money if everybody makes money, but I think they will continue to be part of the landscape. I think it's great for companies that they have more options, and also whether you go public or a direct listing or a SPAC. And I also think it's a positive that more companies are considering going public as a source, not just of capital, but also then getting a currency that can be used to potentially acquire the businesses. There could be other strategic benefits. I've been a little worried in the last year, partly because the late stage markets, particularly powered by SoftBank for a while, were so robust and was so easy to raise a lot of money at a high valuation that people put off IPOs. But I actually think being public does have some benefits. And frankly, I saw that firsthand with AOL. When we went public in 1992, as the first internet company to go public, we raised just $10 million in that IPO. The value of the company that day was $70 million. 8 years later, because of the growth of AOL, and we made several dozen acquisitions, the company was worth $160 billion and was actually the best performing stock of the decade. We would not have been able to run that momentum play, that roll up other businesses play, if we didn't have a public currency. So I'm glad to see more entrepreneurs, instead of trying to delay an IPO or being public as long as possible, being open to the idea that it might actually be some benefits of being public. Certainly the companies that we're backing, I urge to look at the traditional IPO path, also look at where appropriate, in a few cases, direct listings, and also look at the SPAC option.
We've talked to several prominent entrepreneurs who are starting SPACs. There are also many VC firms that are doing their own SPACs. Do you think that it's appropriate for VCs to do SPACs? And is this something that Revolution is going to do?
I think it's appropriate. I think everybody should have an opportunity, if they want to do it, to do it. I think things will settle out in terms of the SPAC sponsors that really can add strategic value. And yes, we are looking at it as well, although most of our focus in the last few months has been either taking companies public via SPAC, as we did with DraftKings and a number of our companies in our portfolio, particularly our later stage Revolution Growth portfolio, are in active conversation with SPAC sponsors right now.
Steve, this is going back to the Rise of the Rest Fund, but you referenced Magic Leap in some interview, and you mentioned they recruited hundreds of engineers who moved from places like Silicon Valley to South Florida. This company seems anomalous in so many ways, but I just wonder, do you think in any way that it's created a setback in the minds of VCs who think, oh, I don't know, maybe investing in a company that's out of view, working on something that we're not actually seeing regularly is maybe not such a good idea?
Yeah, no, it's obviously been a disappointment. They got hyped and raised a ton of money, hired a ton of people, and then just wasn't able to execute against that product vision and has had to retrench. And I haven't talked to them lately, but it sounds like they're focusing more on the enterprise business. But they're an outlier. The companies we're seeing all around the country, including some of the ones we've backed it through Revolution, are really doing breakthrough things. And I think as people realize that in this third wave of the internet, where the internet meets everyday life, that it does, as we've discussed, impact some of the most important sectors of the economy. Some of the expertise in those sectors, much of the expertise is in different parts of the country, not just in Silicon Valley. Some of the key partners you need to forge relationships with are in other parts of the country. Tempest is an example that I mentioned in Chicago, just started 5 years ago, doing extremely well in part because of the partnerships they formed, including with most of the major cancer research institutions in the country. And Tempest, by the way, announced their last round, I think it was about a $5 billion round. That company didn't exist 5 years ago. So I think we're seeing more and more examples. So I'd say certainly Magic Leap was a disappointment, but it strikes me as an outlier.
You've invested in so many great companies all over the place, including, I think I talked to you years ago about BigCommerce and Optoro. BigCommerce helping small businesses better compete with Amazon, and Optoro helping e-commerce retailers handle returns. Just wondering, for listeners who are curious to see where you're shopping now, what are some of the trends that you're following that are maybe not being discussed quite as much in the news?
Well, I'd say there's two broad trends, and we've covered some of it, that we're focused on that maybe others are not as focused on. One is this dispersion of innovation. So we tend to not focus on investing in Silicon Valley because we figure everybody else is focused there. Why don't we do something a little bit different? And that ties in with our Rise of the Rest strategy. And the second ties in with this hypothesis around the third wave of the internet. We really do believe in this next wave. Partnerships and policy matter more. So we are focused in sectors and backing companies where that's a key dynamic. I mentioned with Tempest, also in the case of Clear, that's a good example where they built some interesting technology, but that technology was worthless unless they got airports to adopt it and get the TSA to permit it. So the battle was not around creation of the technology, although of course that was important. The real battle there was around partnerships and policy. So that's our bias here at Revolution, is on place and also on partnerships and policy, what we call the P's.
Interesting. Also, Steve, before I let you go, I have to ask, of course, because a few days after this comes out, we're having an election here. Any thoughts about whether a Biden administration would be good or bad for startups? My impression from in other interviews is that potentially not so great for big tech, very good for startups.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Full disclosure, I've known Vice President Biden for nearly 30 years and am a supporter and hope he'll win. I do expect he'll win. I think for starters, it will settle things down. A little bit of stability would be good. I think it will help us rethink some important issues, particularly around immigration. We're losing what's now a global battle for talent. He has talked about the need for more investment in basic research, which has powered a lot of innovations, including the internet. It wouldn't have really been leadership positions for the United States unless the government had funded that basic research. He's also talked about the need for a more inclusive economy and has a number of initiatives there. And he's also talked about a need to level a playing field in terms of opportunity. It ties in with our Rise of the Rest theme. So, you know, sure, venture capitalists might be concerned about specific things. Things likely will change around K-12 carried interest, and more broadly, there'll be some changes to tax policy. There'll be some reassessment of regulatory policy. It's always the case, a mixed bag, but I have Biden administration. I think it will be good for the country and also good for startups.
So interesting that you think carried interest might be on the chopping block, Steve. Do you have any particular insights into this?
No, not really. That was part of their economic plan or the Biden candidacy. So I presume it's something that will be discussed as part of this overall review of taxes. So I have no particular insight into whether it'll end up happening or not, but I do expect it will be on the table.
Right, right. It's always a hot potato. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. I know you're very busy and really admire what you're working on and very appreciative of your time.
Well, thanks, Connie and Alex. Really enjoyed it.
That's it. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. We're all in for a bumpy week. Take care, and we'll see you next Friday.